Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show is brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that believes long-term relationships deliver sustainable results. That's African Asset. APSA is a registered FSP. This is The Money Show. It is Wednesday night. We're going to talk to Dr. Crispian Olver in a moment. He is an author. He's a local government expert about today's decisions within the city of Johannesburg to appoint an ANC mayor and what the consequences of that are likely to be. There are going to be lots of battles, of course, as we become very used to in the current jousting for political positioning and power within local government. Kyle Cowan published a fantastic video this morning where he's from News 24, he went into the Bosasa safe and it was fabulous. He took us in and he went, and that's the table where the millions were counted at the end of every month. He's been the big auction today. We'll find out how Bosasa's wrapping up. Former board member at Cricket SA, former board member at ShopRite, Shirley Zinn in the last month has resigned from two boards on points of principle. We don't see non-executive directors of company doing that. It's a very, very unusual. The last one I recall was Iraj Abedian when he stepped down from the board of Munich Re. He stepped down from the board of Munich Re, and he did that because Munich Re wouldn't fire KPMG as auditors at a time where lots of people were firing KPMG. Also, on principle, Munich Re ended up firing KPMG, and Iraj Abedian, is no longer on that board. The biggest brands in the world and how fast they're growing, Colin Cullis with Business Unusual, Wendy Nola, and finally, the brand new owner of Destiny Man and Destiny Magazine.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious.
Well, South Africa's richest city back in ANC hands. Jeff Makubo, ANC nominee for the Joburg mayor, will take that job following the resignation of Herman Mashaba last month. Dr. Crispian Olver is the author of two books on local government. One, How to Steal a City, the story of the ANC looting of Nelson Mandela Bay. And recently, A House Divided, about the dysfunction and how that damaged the DA within the city of Cape Town. Crispian Olver, what do you make of today's changes in the city of Johannesburg?
Good evening, Bruce. Well, I mean, what a surprising outcome. Who would have thought that in the first, the very first round of voting, any one of the three parties was going to seal a victory? Then for the ANC, with only 121 seats in council, to actually get 137 votes. Now, that means that they stacked up most of the smaller parties. I mean, they must have had the IFP, the AIC, four of the other one-seat parties, and they must have taken three votes off the DA. Three DA members must have voted with them, because the EFF basically stuck the mandate. They had 30 seats in council. They got 30 votes for their candidate, Musa Novela. The DA, thought they could rely on the ACDP and the Freedom Front plus to vote with them. That should have given them 104 seats. They only got, 104 votes. They only got 101 votes.
Ah, right. So, I see your maths.
So three people defected, and that is very surprising.
The politics of this thing is terrifying and it's interesting, and the changes are astounding. What is most interesting to me is how the EFF didn't back either side, or neither side was willing to be backed by the EFF. EFF are not seen as perhaps a helpful partner within the city of Johannesburg with Herman Mashaba as mayor. That wasn't always an easy relationship, although regarded as king makers in this process before the vote happened, they turned out to turn up for neither side.
Yeah, I think the EFF strategy backfired a bit on them. I mean, I watched them marching into the chamber this morning in their red overalls and gumboots and hard hats. They were very confident. They were singing there needs to be change, and they were making that motion with the hands. So I knew they were going to be, they weren't going to be voting with the DA. That seemed pretty clear. But the ANC rolled home without needing to rely on the EFF vote. And I think that sets up quite an interesting dynamic for whatever, you know, coalition is put together. The ANC is not going to be as beholden to them as the DA were in putting their mayoral committee together and in making decisions about governing. I mean, the ANC still has to get their budgets passed. So, you know, that's another hurdle which they'll only have to cross next year when they're passing their budget for the following financial year.
What does this outcome mean for the residents of Johannesburg?
look, it, you know, in terms of seeing visible improvements, the time that the ANC's got left to govern, up until 2021, which is the next local government election, it's going to be very hard to say that you're going to see much difference. Certainly the grand promise of Mashaba's administration proved to, you know, he won a few victories, but he also gave an enormous amount away. It was a fractious coalition. There was a trumpeting of xenophobia that was completely inappropriate. There were deals done to keep the EFF in the tent that were unholy, and which I'm, you know, busy writing about in the next book on Joburg. So, you know, I think Mashaba's got a little bit of a mixed record. You know, he did crack down on corruption. He cleaned out a lot of officials. I mean, he cleaned out anyone that he thought was ANC aligned, good or bad. So, you know, unfortunately, Joburg lost some really good managers like Lisa Seftel and Sean Phillips. So I think it's going to take a while to stabilize. What I hope is that a more unified approach to coalition government is going to be followed. You know, this thing hangs too much on a knife edge. If parties are going to, you know, stand on their platforms and pursue an oppositional politics, it's going to be bad for the city.
So is this the death of coalitions then? Because, I mean, we've seen coalitions in, we saw coalitions in Nelson Mandela Bay, that ended up in the kicking out of Athol Trollope, and we've seen a disaster since then with the UDM's Bobani in charge, and now even the ANC wants to get rid of Bobani, even though there was huge support for him just to get rid of Trollope. And now we've seen this collapse of what should have been a cooperative level of governance between the DA and the EFF in the interests of citizens, but it just gets too fractious and messy.
Look, we're going to have coalitions for a long time to come. I mean, in principle, electoral competition in our cities is a good thing. Voters need choice. The idea of, you know, and moving away from one party dominance is very good for our electoral system. I think we're seeing coalition politics maturing a bit. I mean, all the parties are learning the ins and outs and whys and wherefores of coalitions and what not to do and what goes badly wrong. And the one thing that has emerged out of this period is that you've got to have some kind of principles that underlie the coalition. You can't just have a coalition that's about keeping the ANC out of power. That's not a basis for governing. You have to find a little bit more common ground than that in order to be able to put a governing platform together. I mean, the one positive thing is that Jeff Makubo is an experienced pair of hands. He's been around. He was part of the Parks Tower generation. He has the regiment capital cloud hanging over.
Yes, that's the problem.
Maybe he's learned some lessons from that and isn't going to try and repeat the same sort of, you know, playing fast and furious with city contracts. That we'll have to keep a very close eye on.
We live in hope. When's the book out? When's the Joburg book out? You've done Nelson Mandela Bay. You've done Cape Town. When is Joburg out?
These things take time. It's at least a year away. I'm hoping to get it out at the beginning of 2021. So in time for the next election.
Got you. Okay, good timing. Dr. Crispian Olva, thank you. Author, local government expert, Dr. Crispian Olva. Bruce Whitfield on 702. Well, one of the best things you will see on the internet today is a video report by the News 24 investigative reporter Kyle Cowan, who's been inside Bosasa into the famous safe where we saw the table that was used to hold the bags that Gavin Watson at the end of each month would stuff bundles of cash into millions of rand every single month to go and pay a network of bribes that had to be paid. Kyle Cowan, had you ever been into those offices before?
Hi, Bruce. Well, this was the second time I was in, but the first time I was never allowed past the reception area.
And this time the offices were, of course, completely empty because it was fire sale day.
Correct, yes. So we went on the first day of viewing for the auction, which started today, and everything was open and we could generally just stroll through and take a look at whatever we wanted. And there were just one or two offices where some admin employees were still working that were off limits, which obviously, I would have loved to get in there, but I had a security guard following me, making sure that I wasn't going to pocket any documents that I wasn't supposed to have a look at. But yeah, well, I mean, we pretty much had free reign of the place, and I was able to spend a couple of hours just walking around and taking in the sights, as it were.
What was it like? Does it feel any different from any other office you've ever been in? Did it have a stench of corruption about it? I don't know. What's your instinct?
Well, for me, definitely, but I might be coming from a slightly biased point of view. But you know, I actually wrote in a piece for News 24 that you know it is a very surreal place because as soon as you walk past the front gate, you know you're in a different world. You're not in Krugersdorp anymore. You could be somewhere in Spain. You know, there's palm trees and luscious gardens, and the lawn is all green and it's very well maintained and exceptionally meticulously cleaned every day, and for me, walking around, what I just noticed and the overwhelming feeling that I got was that, you know, there are these 20,000 rand leather armchairs in these like little reception areas. And I thought to myself, well, this is all government money. This is all from government contracts. And this is all the proceeds essentially of crime. And it just made me feel a little bit nauseous and a little bit sad that such an exceptionally well-run operation that provided employment to more than 4,000 people had made such a very, very sticky end.
Yeah, I mean, it was built off the back of corruption, and that's the great tragedy of it, of course, and people knew it. I mean, Angelo Gritti showed the video of Gavin Watson packing the bags. Was it weird going into the safe and seeing the table that you were so familiar with where the bags of cash had been packed?
Yes. Yeah, it was very weird. I mean, right down to, you know, the 25 cents that was left in the one safe, which was, you know, the only sign of money in the place. But what was also very strange about the safe...
Did you pocket that?
No, I didn't. Just checking, but I had to take checking. A picture of it.
Okay.
No, I mean, and just the actual safe itself, you know, it's pretty well hidden away. If you're walking past this little section of office on the outside, you wouldn't know anything different from any of the other office buildings. And, you know, as you walk into the safe, it's got a very large sort of like beige steel door. And as you open it, you just realize that it is not at all in tune with what the rest of the offices look like. It looks like a dingy, you know, scrappy little office, you know, in a corner of some massive building that's 20,000 years old. It's got this really old, dirty brown carpet and this really cheap furniture and this three massive safes standing in the corner. And it just doesn't hold any correlation to what it looks like when you just step outside of the safe, which has these expensive tiles and expensive sort of office furniture right next door. It's just a very, very strange little corner of that office park.
Well, maybe the one that reflects the true underbelly of the company right from the start. Kyle Cowan, thank you. Investigative journalist at News 24, inside Bosasa for the big auction.
The Money Show. The Markets.
Neil Brown is our market commentator. He is with Electus Fund Managers. A bit of a bounce today in an otherwise quite lethargic market, Mr. Brown.
Yes, evening, Bruce. Yeah, the market's up close to 1% today, and I think Europe was stronger, and the US is strong as well.
Why is this market not falling on its face, considering that we are teetering on the very brink of recession?
Yeah, I think we've discussed before, but I think that's a hard thing to separate, which is the economy and the level of the market. And yes, the economy is not looking at all pretty, and we saw GDP figures earlier this week, and it's...
-0.6%,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, so it's not good. And I think people know that, and I think expectations are, because of that, incredibly low. So, you know, anytime any company does something remotely good, the share prices are more inclined to go up now than down, and I think that's because the level of the market is quite low.
And we always forget, of course, 70% of the profits of the top 40 companies of the JSE are not from South Africa. These are globally diversified companies. These are international businesses.
Thank goodness. And yeah. I think, you know, that's maybe the difference with someone like Brazil. You know, at least our stock market, you can diversify globally quite easily and into some good quality businesses.
Discovery held a conference call today, and I think everyone's terribly interested in Adrian Gore's decision to sell down about 10% of his shares in Discovery earlier this week. Came through a very complicated announcement of zero-cost collars and braces, and I think there was a spanner in the works. And, you know, executives always like to explain away, oh, no, we're just, you know, diversifying. And I was talking to an executive this week who was saying it doesn't matter what people say in the SENS announcement. When directors are selling, it sends a very clear signal that they don't, you know, that they think there's better opportunities elsewhere. And so, yeah, Adrian Gore was doing that. And of course, there were some management changes that they're announced as well. So, I mean, Discovery under pressure bounced a bit today, but it has been on a downward trend.
Yeah, it's fallen by almost 20% in the last, say, 6 weeks or so. And it had a bounce post its June results and then it came down again. And I think there were talks on the leadership changes. This is all in an announcement from last week. So it's nothing new, really. I think people.
But I think they must be coming under quite a lot of pressure to give some answers, because for Discovery to have a conference call to explain itself is unusual.
Yeah. And I think there were quite a few leadership changes. Most of the same, all the same faces. So it's all the same people, with the exception of a director moving from exec director to non-exec director in the UK. But the rest of the same faces, just a slightly different jobs and different explanations as to what they're doing and who's responsible for what. And I think regarding his shares, I mean, he has followed all the rights offers over time. And this collar is in place to protect essentially about a quarter of his shares that he owns. But I think, you know, when people see these, they don't like them. Chris Avisa has one on ShopRite that's coming up next week.
That's a big one. That's like a 3 billion rand one, isn't it?
Huge. Yeah. And I think as investors, you generally don't like it. You like to see directors either buying shares
or selling them.
And if they want to sell the shares, they're entitled to do it. But you want clean structures. You'd prefer not to see the complexity of these kind of type of structures.
Get off the pot. People get off the pot. I mean, it's made them tell us what you're thinking. Sunlum, they came out with weird sort of like 7 month updates, 8 month updates, 10 month updates. They seem to be going along quite nicely. How is the Saham deal happening? It's made Sunlum a massive African player in insurance.
Yeah, I mean, I think they put quite a good spin on it. I don't think it's proving that successful. And Sunlum is a business that's done incredibly well over the last 15 or so years. Their leadership's been good. They've done all the hard yards, and they're reaping the benefits. But I think they've run out of road a little bit, and that's why I guess they go for Saham. And I think making money in the rest of Africa is tough. They've got some hard work to do still. It's a 10-month update, so you can't really get any clear facts, but I think it's a reasonably priced business. It's not cheap.
How does the whole battle over broadband play out? Government or Competition Commission wants MTN and Vodacom to slash their prices to treat everybody equally, whether you're buying 5 megs or 500. It looks like the MTNs and the Vodacoms of the world are digging in their heels a bit.
Yeah, it's complex, Bruce. And I think one of the frustrating things about South Africa is we are too bureaucratic. So you've got the government have the policy.
Could you just, before you go, by the way, could you just fill in a few forms to say that you've been there? Yeah, carry on.
We're too bureaucratic. You have the government setting policy and a minister of telecoms. Then you get ICASA, which is the regulator. It's meant to be independent. And then you get Competition Commission now ruling that data prices are too high and they must cut them. Obviously, MTN put out something today saying we're going to fight it and we disagree with the rulings and all that. But a lot of it comes down to, yes, our data prices are too high. But on the other hand, we haven't really introduced any spectrum for a long time.
And that's one of the great criticisms that the cell phone operators, as I understand it, have got. They've got much cheaper sort of access to the internet in many other African countries, and that is true. But those countries have made that extra spectrum available. And South Africa's government, for whatever reason, insists on sitting on spectrum that should be made publicly available. They just, I guess, can't find a mechanism to do it that's politically palatable to them.
Yeah, I think there's more and more data that people need to transmit and transfer, and that's what spectrum's for. It's speed, it's download speed, it's dropped calls, and I think it has to happen. But you know, and it's been meant to have happened for the last 2 years. And
it's longer than that.
It's still meant to happen next year. Yeah. But I think, you know, people, yes, they probably have to pay for spectrum, but at the same time, maybe there's a quid pro quo saying, well, you can get the spectrum, but boy, you drop your data prices.
And they will, because they've said they will.
Well, yes, but maybe that has to be written down.
Absolutely. We reserve the right to take your extra spectrum away if you don't bring your prices down by 40 and 50%. I mean, there should be a carrot and a stick here. And unfortunately, right now, there's just a stick.
Yeah. I mean, I think it has to happen. But I think the consumer loses out, and I think business loses out, and the economy loses out.
Investors lose out. Share prices of the cell phone providers are down quite sharply on the week so far. My thanks to Neil Brown from Electus Fund Managers. After Eyewitness News, Shirley Zinn, who's not just quit yesterday from Cricket South Africa, a month ago she also left the board of ShopRite. Not too many people will exercise principle where it costs them money. This has cost her lots of money. We'll find out how much and why she's taken these big steps in a couple of minutes' time.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that believes long-term partnerships deliver sustainable results. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
You've never seen a bigger group of kids than NATO members gossiping about Donald Trump and taking the mickey out of Donald Trump. I mean, these are the guys with buttons, you know, any red number of red buttons in the world that they could push at any moment and destroy the entire planet. But their favorite sort of commonality right now is NATO, is Donald Trump. And they just, they clearly think the man's a buffoon. That's there. View. But yes, very funny. And in a world where also cameras are absolutely everywhere, it's very hard to get away with making a joke at somebody else's expense. Shirley Zinn coming up in a moment. She is a director of increasing repute. We'll talk to her about her decision to step away from boards in recent months. On your next Money Show, Barry Omani, the financial planner at Veritas Wealth, talking about the financial things you need to do if you're planning to leave South Africa. And if you don't have enough money, why you'll join the I'm Staying Brigade. And in our personal finance feature, also Pavlo Fitidis with this week's small business and all the other big money stories from the day too. And there's a whole lot of stuff going on.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Welcome to The Money Show. And there's a saying, and it's coined by an old US ad man: a principle's not a principle until you're prepared to lose money over it. How many directors do we hear about resigning from companies because they disagree with the direction a company is taking, or they're worried about governance at the company, they're worried about decisions that the companies have made, and they try and fix things from within the business, but nobody's listening, or they just simply refuse, and then it leads to a conflict and they resign. And once they resign, how many put up their hand and say, I resigned because of this? Very, very few. Iraja Bedian, the economist who quit Munich Re 2 years ago over that company's refusal to fire KPMG over state capture, he resigned, and it made Munich Re's life really difficult. And they eventually did fire KPMG, along with a whole bunch of other companies as well. Last month, Shirley Zinn resigned from ShopRite after Christo Visser pulled rank with his high voting shares to overrule 61% of shareholders who wanted him out. And last night, she cited governance concerns and she quit the board of Cricket South Africa as well. She's a board member at companies, or is it just one company now, Shirley Zinn? The only company I can find where you're still a board member is Sanlam. I'm wondering when you're going to be giving Ian Kirk a call.
Good evening, Bruce, and thank you very much for teeing it up in that way. I will not... do not anticipate, absolutely not doing that.
Excellent. Well, that's good news. Yeah. But, I mean, you have, in all seriousness, you've taken in the last month two significant decisions that cost you personally because you can't have yourself associated with companies behaving in particular ways.
Thank you, Bruce. Yeah, so Bruce, you know, for me, corporate governance and principles are very, very important and of course, values. And I think that, you know, I'll speak more for Cricket South Africa now because I want to, that is the thing that we're talking about here tonight, is really there were a couple of things, and I really tried in the year or so that I was there to, you know, give guidance, advice, support, enable. But, you know, I got to a point this weekend where I really, you know, said to myself, the time has come. You know, and it was about the matter of the withdrawal of the accreditation of the journalists to the game, and I just thought that was an appalling decision. I don't know who would have made that decision, but clearly quite unacceptable. That was the first thing, and the second thing was the Sunday Times article on Graham Smith which I thought, I was just shocked when I actually saw that article.
What were you shocked about? Because you'd participated in the interviews to appoint him to Cricket South Africa's director of cricket, and I think the board was trying to convince him to take the job. He was worried about governance issues. The next thing the story appears that he's going to be appointed. And what was shocking to you about that? Was it the fact that it was leaked? What was it?
Well, we're in very sensitive terrain when it comes to recruitment governance and processes around recruitment and how we treat our candidates and giving the respect, to that process and to the people concerned. So until somebody signs a contract, you can't be writing articles that you haven't cleared with anybody and create, a set of circumstances that is just untenable. That is completely unacceptable. So it's really put the whole process into a very difficult position. And as you know, Bruce, we are getting closer to a major event here, and we are working very hard on filling very key vacancies. And you cannot compromise a process or a candidate like this. And in this case, I think I just felt that this was a confidential process. And here it was all over the pages of the Sunday newspaper, and I felt that was just the final straw for me. So I have huge respect and deep admiration for Graham, and if he were to come, it would be absolutely amazing to enthuse and inspire and uplift our cricket and take it forward. And we really wanted to give him the space to make that call, and this put him into a very precarious predicament. So I had to then say to myself, where does this leave me now? What does this require of me to do? And I then decided, I have to step away from this. I can't align myself with this, and I cannot accept this. And I then decided to do this resignation, and hoped that in the hope that something good will come out of it. It will be a catalyst for the change we need to see, for the decisiveness, for the good governance, and for the future of the game. I'm hoping that all of these conversations that we are happening around this will ensure that we put the game first, we put South Africa first, we put the players first, and we make sure that we follow our procedures, our MRIs, our constitutions, our charters that we sign up for, and our fiduciary duties are being making sure that those are executed as professionally as we possibly can.
And I know you don't want to talk about ShopRite, and I'm not going to push you in that direction, but you took a principal decision to step away from the board of ShopRite as well a month ago. And this is a big step, because here you are, an HR professional all of your working career, now looking to build a portfolio of non-executive directorships, as many people do when they've had a long career in business. It's a gainful use of your time and a good good employment, and you've sacrificed essentially two non-executive checks in order to stay true to yourself. Not many people do that, Shirley. What is it in you that made you say, I'm willing to give up the money because I can't take the way decisions are being made here, or whatever the case might be?
So, Bruce, thank you for saying that, and it really does mean a lot. I mean, these are very, very trying times and very difficult decisions that one has to make, and the question always is, if I stay, can I change it? If I go, what will it make a difference? What will change? And for me, the first thing is, if it's out of alignment with my personal, sense of values, I feel it's out of alignment with MRIs and charters and everything that is required of us from a King IV perspective, from a Companies Act perspective, then, I really need to reflect on and interrogate myself to say, is this right? And if it's not right, what are you actually doing? And so it goes beyond the money, really, to the principle that says, now you really got to put your money where your mouth is and do the right thing. You want to be a role model. You want to be a good leader. You want to, change things. And we see the amount of you know, scandals that have emerged. And that is because people, you know, somehow think that if they look the other way, things will get better or go away, you know. And I think we need to be brave and courageous and stand up for what we believe in. Otherwise, you know, what is the purpose? What is the meaning of life if you can't do that?
Yeah, you know? I mean, and many people haven't got the guts to do it. I mean, I look at, you know, your sort of decision is quite a lot like whistleblowers within organizations who stand up and say, we can't behave like this anymore, and it wreaks havoc within organizations. They find it hard to get jobs. They, in many cases, people face some quite hard times. In the world of non-executive directorships, if you're seen as somebody who doesn't, you know, stand for nonsense, are you likely to be invited to many more boards?
Well, Bruce, yeah, that's an interesting question. So I have had overwhelming responses to this, a whole variety of responses, mainly very, very positive and optimistic ones, you know, and conversations that start to dissect, you know, what does it mean to be principled? What does it mean to take a position on and take a stand on things, even if you have to stand alone, you know, and have the courage of your convictions and stand up and be counted. And so I think, you know, more and more we need to work hard at trying to build our resilience around this and actually do it. Because if we don't, we're going to find our economy in continuous decline. We're going to find unethical behavior being condoned. You're going to, you know, you're on a hiding to nowhere if you continue to do that. And so, I had interesting conversations with a whole variety of different people, and I'm not rushing to replace one the job with another. That's not the purpose. So I am I'm trying to, you know, work through what, you know, the aftermath of all of this is, and then I'll figure it out from there. But I think if good follows good. So I think you know, people will make up their own minds about, you know, whether you do add value and whether you are true to yourself and whether you are going to come and make a difference on their boards into the future.
Thank you, Shirley Zinn, board member of companies and somebody who's standing up for what she believes in. Principles. Remember those. Remember principles. Not your head teacher at school. The things that make you tick, the things that differentiate you from other people, the things that where you say no when others are going yes, 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 they make you stand out. She's standing out, she's taking a risk, and she should be very proud of the position she's taking.
WhatsApp Bruce on 072-702-1702.
Well, NASPAS, a big beneficiary. Well, actually, it's Prosus, the big beneficiary of the 2019 Brand Finance Fastest Growing Brand Study. NASPAS, a winner because it owns 70% of Prosus, and Prosus owns 30% of Tencent in China, which owns WeChat. And WeChat is, Jeremy Sampson, Managing Director of Brand Finance, the world's fastest growing brand.
You've got it, Bruce. And when you think of these brands, and a lot of them we haven't heard of, and the top 100 from around the world, 39 are Chinese, 39 are American, and of all the Chinese ones, I would suggest we probably heard of less than 5% of them, but they are the fastest growing brands in the world.
And 8 of the top 10 fastest growers are Chinese. One is American and one is Porsche.
Exactly. And, you know, you've just had an ad for SUVs. That's the reason Porsche has done so well. They were the first of the luxury guys to get into SUVs. You know, most top-end ladies in this country want to drive a Porsche SUV. The guys stick to the cars. But that's the real reason. It's grown by 734% compound annual growth over the last 5 years, which is phenomenal.
And it explains, at least in part, trade wars. I mean, the fact is that brands used to be American. Brands used to be European. Very few brands would come out of anywhere else, not global brands anyway. And suddenly, out of the top 100, 39 are American, 39 are Chinese, and the Chinese are dominating the fastest growers. Donald Trump is scared.
Well, he should be very, very scared. In fact, any European or American brand should be very, very scared unless they're in China and in that part of the world. You know, there's a huge population there who have become emancipated over the last couple of decades, have got money to spend, and boy, are they spending it. But with the lack of the European American brands into China, then the Chinese are creating their own brands. and they're making absolute hay. This is the big story this year, the dominance, the increasing dominance of Chinese brands, and hey, they're coming to a place called Africa.
Jeremy Sampson, thank you, Managing Director at Brand Finance Africa.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that believes long-term partnerships deliver sustainable results. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP. There weren't any major catastrophes on Black Friday. No internet sites fell over. I don't think it was a mess. But lots of people are very grumpy with some of the people who participated in Black Friday, companies that did, and they feel they got ripped off, and they've been barraging Wendy Nola with all kinds of complaints. And she'll share those with us this evening and what the brands need to do better. And then an interesting phenomenon I'm going to bounce off her, and that is, have you noticed that people you owe money to, so you get your usual debit orders, they come off, you know, usually probably after the 25th of the month, maybe after the 27th, 28th, 30th, maybe 31st if you're lucky. Suddenly there are lots of people saying, could you pay us on the 15th? Because they worry that you're going to run out of money. And they want their money from you before you go and spend it on fun stuff at Christmas time. But just what is the position with that? I wonder if Wendy's got an answer for us. And then Colin Cullis, he's up next, as well as our shapeshifter. And tonight's shapeshifter is the brand new owner of Destiny and Destiny Man magazines.
The Money Show.
Business Unusual with Colin Cullis.
Business Unusual brought to you by DSTV Business. Get the stay package and elevate your guests' experience. DSTV Business. Entertainment is their business. What have pandemics got to do with Business Unusual?
Well, we talk about disruption, and we tend to assume that that disruption is coming from some bright and sparkly new amazing technology thing. But given that this last weekend we marked the 31st anniversary of the world saying HIV is a real problem, and despite the progress, we're still a good couple of years away from actually saying we've now got a vaccine.
We haven't got a cure, but we've managed to tame the beast. I mean, antiretroviral programs have become far more effective. The doses are far more friendly. People don't feel horrendous on the drugs. And people are having perfectly normal lives, taking carefully structured courses of antiretrovirals. We haven't beaten it, but it hasn't beaten us.
It hasn't. And generally, I mean, we've been around now for a good couple of thousand years, and we're pretty good, and we've shown how resilient we are. But it doesn't mean it doesn't come at huge costs. And so this evening I wondered, might be a good opportunity to look at the kind of disruption that comes from a pandemic, because
there's a fabulous book which looks too thick for me to have sufficient time to read and to focus on. Rabbit. What? It's about the 1919 Spanish flu. And at the end of World War I, there was a global pandemic of influenza, which afflicted mostly women and almost restored the male-female balance in the world. It's one of those weird things that happened. And that was the last major global pandemic, I think.
No. That certainly is one of the high watermark ones, and yeah. I'm going to be giving you some more details about it. But they're ongoing, and for most of the experts, the question isn't if we'll have another pandemic to rival something as significant as that, just the question of when and how will we react. In fact, right now, there is a epidemic underway in Samoa of measles, a disease that we've actually had or supposedly had under control for years.
And then the nutty anti-vaxxers, watch my Twitter feed, nutty anti-vaxxers, yes, I said nutty anti-vaxxers, in really the developed parts of the world are going, no, I don't vaccinate my children because, I don't know, for whatever reason.
Well, that was exactly the cause that's been attributed to the outbreak there at the moment. A few years ago, there was a couple of deaths as a result of poorly administered vaccines, not a problem with the vaccines. And this is the thing, we come to believe that medical advances have made us safe, that if anything happens to us, we go and grab a pill and we'll be okay. But vaccinations don't work that way. And in fact, there's some of the terminology might be quite useful. So endemic diseases are ones where the viral loads, the cases of them occurring, is pretty stable. So the regular winter flus are kind of endemic. On occasions, though, we'll get a new strain or variety, or we wouldn't have seen it necessarily.
The H1...
Well, the most famous one is the H1N1, and I'll touch on why they have these names. But then they become, when they increase beyond the normal numbers, that's an epidemic. expands into new regions. And a pandemic is when it effectively starts moving outside of countries and across continents. And the idea of or how best to control outbreaks of diseases, long before we knew what a disease was, we knew that if you just isolated someone, basically just get them away from us, we wouldn't get infected. And we can thank the Venetians for being particularly controlling in this regard, that they controlled ports. When a ship arrived from a destination they believed to be high risk, they would make them wait at anchor for 40 days.
Quarantine.
Literally means 40 days.
Quarantine, yes.
Yes, quarantino. And the second word that we can thank the Italians for is the word itself, flu. It was believed that the thing that gave us the flu were astrological influences. And Italian for influence is influenza. And that's kind of stuck. And that big one, you're absolutely right to point out, occurred just after the First World War. And it had sort of the perfect storm for how it occurred. The first one maybe to say is the Spanish flu. So it came from Spain, right? No, it came from the US.
Obviously.
Well, and because the First World War was underway and America was sending troops, 2 million in all, across from America to Europe, the outbreak hadn't been fully understood or fully diagnosed in the US, but was able to start spreading. And because ships back in 1919 were capable of getting across the Atlantic in less than 40 days, those ships were effectively fantastic breeding grounds for the disease. Once people landed in Europe, they were exposed to a disease they had no resistance to, and it absolutely spread. The Spanish weren't part of the First World War, and so restrictions on reporting was a little less there. So it occurred more in newspapers, etc., and other people started referring to it by the coverage it got in Spanish press, and that's how it became known as the Spanish flu. And you might have thought, well, once we dealt with that one, once that one burnt itself through the population, as it were, then everybody who survived had a sort of a resistance to it, and we'd be good. That is kind of true. That is how we build up resistances to viruses. But it came at a cost of between 50 and the upper estimates are 100 million people. That's more than the number of people who died in the First World War. And the challenge comes from how viruses work. And viruses and bacteria are two different things. Viruses, and certainly the flu virus, I'm just going to focus on that one for this evening, come in, well, four kinds. B and C types only affect humans. Type D affects only animals. But the type A virus is the one we're most concerned about because it can affect animals and us. And those H1N1 refer to the two kinds of ways that the virus itself is able to be identified. And there are 144 variations that they can occur in. You effectively have to contract each one of those before you can say you will not be affected by them. And so every year when somebody says you should go for your flu shot, you kind of think, but I've already done that. Why do I need to do it again? Well, every year there is a new mutation of it where the H and the N's possibly change. And then these are very clever viruses. They're the oldest living things on the planet, if you consider viruses living. And so they can remix their DNA, effectively making our bodies not that good at being able to identify what's going on. And in 2009, the H1N1 had another breakout in America. Now, globally, the UN World Health Organization have been very hard at work to ensure that we minimize the risk and we improve our way to respond to these diseases. But even then, in 2009, in less than a year, with them basically tracking that disease from the first person that was identified, over 60 million people got infected. 250,000 people wound up in hospitals, and over 12,000 people died from a virus we knew that had just changed a little bit. And this is the thing that is so difficult with this. We don't see it as a real threat. Ahead of the show, I asked, you know, what do you typically do when you get flu symptoms or when you get the flu? I gave you the option to say, stay home, work if you feel okay, get told to go home, or demand antibiotics. And while the majority, 38%, said stay home, it effectively means that the other two, 50% almost, said that either go to work if they feel okay or get told to go home, which means they are effectively...
spreading the problem.
They're spreading the problem without realizing. And the balance, the 15% who said they demand antibiotics, that was a bit of a trick question because viruses don't typically respond to antibiotics.
Ah, you sneaky devil. But most people feel a bit sick, so they demand antibiotics, even though the antibiotics will have no effect on that particular condition. But it is leading to this huge increase in antibiotic resistance, which is raising the risk of other diseases all over the place.
Exactly right. And actually, when you start affecting your own bacterial sort of makeup while you're suffering from a virus, you're potentially weakening your immune systems even further. Now, that's the kind of stuff that comes from the pure medical, biological kind of stuff. But if you consider, as I'm sure most business owners know only too well during winter time, how hard it is to keep enough people manning the phones or making the sales to keep the business going for a regular flu season, what the impact would be if you have a real big outbreak. In Samoa at the moment, they've shut the schools. They shut them back in November. They have banned, they've got a curfew from the 2nd of December. They have cancelled all public gatherings. I mean, it's coming up for Christmas. You kind of think there's a lot of people looking to get together. And even government offices have been told, we're going to have to shut this just to stop people getting around. The hospitals are overrun. They've had to get special emergency supplies of additional vaccinations, and they've now made it compulsory that you get vaccinated. And there is a very important thing that happens with vaccinations in that you need to have a certain number of people vaccinated for it actually to work. And once you trigger that special point, that is quite high, you get what's known as herd immunity. Effectively, you can protect everybody. And the point about having that, despite some people thinking, it's my choice, I want to do it, very young kids and very elderly and the weak can't get vaccinations because they do have an impact on us when we take them. By ensuring that the disease can't spread, you make it safer for them not to get it. Now, you might think, well, who would be able to advise us? Who should we take the word from on this? Well, Bill Gates is not somebody who hasn't had a chance to think about sort of these things. And he acknowledges environmental risks, economic collapse, nuclear disasters. All of these things he sees as being very real risks. But the probable risk, he reckons, and the one that is more imminent and will probably have the greatest impact for us, will be a pandemic of a virus that we right now simply are not setting aside sufficient funds for research. And
the thing is, when it comes, we wouldn't have seen it before. I mean, at the moment, we're terrified of Ebola, for example. Yeah. Ebola is a horrific disease, and there are occasional outbreaks in places like the DRC. Hans Rosling, have you read his book, Factfulness?
Yes.
So he, and also with this modern news flow happens faster than viruses spread. And I just got an extract from the book. And thousands of people died in a 2009 outbreak of swine flu. And Hans Rosling did some data analysis afterwards. And it was serious. It wasn't as bad as the Spanish flu of 1919. But over a two-week period, Rosling compared real data with public perceptions. And he analyzed during that time that 31 people had died of swine flu. And Google, when he went to Google, threw up 253,443 searches on swine flu. People were terrified of swine flu. So there was a lot spoken about and a lot written about swine flu. It was on the news. 24/7, it was there. During that time, though, 63,000 people died of TB.
Oh, yes.
And each swine flu death had the average of 8,176 articles, and each TB death had 0.1 articles per death. Because we make, you know, we also don't do ourselves any favors because we crying wolf a lot about these pandemics, and then nothing comes to pass. We stop treating them as seriously. And the next time there's a swine flu story, we go, it's not serious. I'm going to go and sit next to the person without the mask on my flight from Singapore.
Exactly right. In fact, there is a link I've put up online of a crowd who do data visualizations, and they plot all of the various highly infectious diseases by how contagious they are and how fatal they are. And one of the ways you can set the grid up is which ones get the most press and media and which ones should be getting the press and the media. Because the challenge isn't just for diseases like tuberculosis. It's a known thing that we need to do. But because it doesn't seem to be new, it doesn't get coverage. And so people sort of don't treat it with the kind of severity or the kind of attention it needs. But the challenge comes from this. They refer to it as a disease X. We know it's out there. It's some mutated version of a flu we haven't seen yet, typically. And the catch is that when that does happen, it is useful for the media to make sure everybody do not mess around.
It is
take this seriously. But what we need to do is now, while there isn't a major flu necessarily, is who is setting aside the money from those very tight budgets? Which businesses are holding or suggesting that they will be stumping up money for research to better prepare us when that comes? Stockpiling resources.
Human nature doesn't allow us to do it because, well, it's not a problem, so why should we worry? We'll worry when it's a problem, if it's ever a problem, and it won't be. Somebody else will fix it anyway.
Until it is.
Colin Cullis with Business Unusual this evening. Thank you, Colin.
702. Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
Wendy Noda now, our consumer ninja. You were concerned last week about Black Friday. You were concerned that lots of people were going to get themselves burned and people were going to spend too much money. And
they
you were
probably
being,
did.
You were being all mummish about it because that's, you know, that, you were concerned, young
well,
people.
That's, yeah, there were people on Twitter saying, just leave us alone, man. Let us enjoy our Black Friday. So, you're fine.
But lots of people did get ripped off, quite legitimately angry about the way in which some companies behaved over that time in terms of the way they dealt with inquiries, in terms of their service, them delivering the product.
We're still going to get the delivery dramas.
And yes. Pricing.
Pricing. So it was happening a lot of, the shade was happening over a lot, towards a lot of companies, but I'm going to do the Takealot thing because they are the biggest online retailer and they did bring Black Friday to South Africa in 2012.
So it's their fault. They can
so they must take it. They have broad shoulders. But yeah, so there was a lot of it's a total scam kind of shade happening on Twitter. People saying the savings were grossly exaggerated. So with regard to a set of, I followed a particular thread about a set of Berlinger pots being sold at 1,999 Rand. Let's call it, be devils and call it 2,000 Rand. Which was claimed to be a 58% saving, right? So pretty significant. And someone tweeted, what a joke is this? I had these in my cart for months at the price of 2,512 Rand. All of a sudden, the original price is 6,028 Rand, daylight fraud. So here's the thing. The savings on online sites, and this includes Amazon, this is how it happens, they are calculated on the list price. Now, what is a list price? The list price is the recommended retail selling price, right? It's set by the manufacturer, not the price that particular site used to sell the product for before
but
Black
that is
Friday.
So infuriating.
That's the assumption that consumers make.
I would have made that assumption.
So would I have. Okay.
That's so dishonest.
So I asked Takealot if. So it's not. It is. So I asked Takealot, here's the thing. Because they said we tracked the prices going back 4 months and the list price stayed at 6,000 and whatever, 28 Rand. So I said, okay, but did Takealot ever sell those pots for 6,028 Rand on behalf of the seller? And she wasn't sure. But she did say that Amazon is selling those in Rand equivalent. They're selling those pots for 6,000 Rand before shipping and customs duties. But the marketplace seller, the person that they have this deal with to sell their products for, in the case of Berlinger pots, that's Precision Cookware, they can choose to discount to whatever price they like, and they do. So sometimes it's 20% off the list price, and sometimes it's 50%. But the point is, it is a bit misleading because I would have thought it would be 58% or 28% of what it used to be selling on that site. Okay, not the list price, which is.
I'm so unhappy with that.
I am a bit. So I think it would be more accurate to base the saving, and I suggested this.
But it's not sexy unless it's not. Unless the number is huge, it's not sexy.
What would make sense and be relevant for consumers would be the saving should be based on the average price the product sold in, say, the past 6 months on that particular site. That would be relevant to consumers. Don't you agree?
You're preaching to the converted. Don't shout at me.
I'm just saying. No, back me up here, Bruce.
I back you up completely, Wendy Nola. And I think it is that's fundamentally dishonest.
Consumers must understand what list price means. It's a recommended retail selling price. It may not ever have been applied. There might have been discounts all the time. So it's really even more reason why you must track the prices yourself.
Absolutely.
So that you know for sure whether it's a good deal or not. The list price is really a little bit meaningless.
Human nature and frenzy and time limits and the desire for a deal unfortunately throws logic out the window.
Yeah.
It really does.
And it's Black Friday, so it must be good.
And how often did people think stuff was on sale and actually wasn't on sale, even though it had been intimated that it was?
What do you mean? That they'd actually bought something?
Yeah. And it's like, oh, sorry, no, that wasn't on sale.
No, so this happens every year. So Michael Sequeira bought a pair of New Balance running shoes for 400 Rand, good price, the day before Black Friday, but it was part of the sale. He got the confirmation email, and like anybody else, he thought it was a done deal. But then he got another email a bit later saying, the wording for me was significant. We would like to inform you that we have initiated a refund as we are not able to supply you with this product. As he says, not even an explanation. So I took it up. with New Balance, and their spokesman said the shoe was sold out in Michael's size, which was a size 8. You can understand that. He said the live nature of e-commerce and a high rate of sales cadence during sales periods means that someone else is likely to have bought the last size 8 in that particular running shoe, possibly moments before Mr. Sequeira did, which, it happens.
I get that it happens, but it's also infuriating that the tech needs to play catch up with this, because
I think so.
You go online, it is deemed to be available, so you buy that. You assume you bought the pair. If at that moment it said to you, sorry, this is the last pair's been sold,
you should be told.
Then
I agree.
Then you go for the $500 pair, or you go for the $600 pair, you go for another deal.
You don't get the confirmation email.
No.
You shouldn't,
no.
I didn't think.
But I also get the fact that, I mean, we spoke to Jacques Cellier, the chief executive of F&B, on Black Friday, and at one point they had 3,000 transactions going through just their bank.
Yes.
Every second.
Yeah, no, that's just so crazy. Yeah. Yes, so the technology, I think, in time will catch up. But for me, a lack of explanation compounds the problem, as it did for this customer. So New Balance said, providing reasons is often seen as making excuses, and in our experience, informing the customer of the situation at once, apologizing and refunding him or her immediately was the most acceptable course of action. And it should be said that they also offered Michael a discount coupon, 40% off his next purchase. Which
40%
is,
off what?
His next purchase.
So
okay.
The price you see, you actually maybe get a better deal that way.
Maybe. That's a... Trust you to think of that. That's true. Anyway, I said to him, and he took it really well, I said, I disagree. In my experience, consumers generally respond better to being given more information rather than less when you've let them down. So if your plane's delayed and they just say...
Sorry, your plane's delayed.
No, what do they say? Operational reasons. That's infuriating. Rather than saying the plane's late from Joburg or the pilot's drunk or whatever, you know, if they're unlikely to say that. But you know what I mean.
Because pilots are highly unlikely to be drunk.
Well, when on duty, we'd like to think so.
No, exactly. I mean, that does happen from time to time. And I guess on a day like Black Friday, you win some, you lose some, and hopefully you win more than you lose.
Well, let's hope so, yes. I like to think I got a good deal on my particular
What did you
week.
Buy?
Well, I bought a rug, and then I said that's all. And then I actually bought a pressure cooker, and it was a good deal because I've been tracking the price, and I actually bought one for someone else that was a lot more expensive. So I have a pressure cooker to cook my Durban curries and whatever else I want in limited time.
That's what takeaways are for. and generally, do you find that are retailers getting better at responding to their customers? Their customers may be infuriated. Are they getting better at that?
Interesting questions. Yes and no. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. I think consumers have taken to social media more readily than in previous years. Mm. So sometimes the social media response team is the way to go because they are mandated and resourced to respond quickly, whereas the guys that are answering the emails and maybe the call center are not as fast where they should be.
We don't have time for this now, but maybe next week if you've got capacity. Got an email from Karabo, and I'm betting I'm going to get a couple more, saying my contracts with all service providers are such that payment is due on the last day or two of the month.
Right.
Why are so many now demanding to be paid before then? Is this even legal?
Because it's December and they want to get their hands on your money spend it all.
Correct. Before you have any fun, they want to take their pound of flesh. But here's my favorite part.
Yes.
Because something is sticking.
Yes.
Please ask Consumer Ninja to look into this.
See what you've done. Well, funnily enough, I have had another email just this week about the same thing.
Next week, do you mind? Can we do that?
Of course I will. Whether they can and can't. And yes, absolutely. I do it every year. Happy to talk about that.
Consumer Ninja, Wendy Nova.
Bruce Whitfield on 702.
The Money Show brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that believes long-term partnerships deliver sustainable results. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP. Coming up in a moment or six, the new owner of Destiny and Destiny Man on The Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
For the curious.
Over the years, we've dealt with many legends. We've spoken to many legends of the business community. Not one of them has been called legend. Until now. Legend Mankele, chief executive and founder at The Bar Group. Is that, did your mom call you legend, or have you just called yourself legend in the hope that one day you will be a legend?
My grandmother called me
your
legend.
Your grandmother? What a woman.
Yeah, she predicted some things.
Are you fulfilling, what is it called? It's called nominative determinism. Are you living up to the name?
I'm trying to, you know. It is a bit difficult. There's a lot of pressure that comes with the name. The other name that I have, a Zulu name called Nkululeko, means freedom. And
freedom to be a legend.
Literally, yeah. So I'm free to be who I want to be, and hopefully I become a legend in the making. You know,
there's a JSE listed company called The Huge Group, and that it started small and it's still small. So hopefully, the legend takes off. You are the new owner of the Destiny magazines. I thought they were dead and buried, and then suddenly I see John Carney staring out of the Destiny Man cover at me the other day. That was nice to see.
Yeah, so essentially I think the biggest thing is I think the company that held them, you know, sank, and not the actual brands.
This was in Dialo Media, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think to be fair, obviously Dialo Media held the brands, but I think the brands were still much, you know, they were needed, and I saw a need for them. You know, as a country, we sit with a 29% unemployment rate. And I think content like this is needed to solve that problem, you know? So I just thought, let's bring these back. Let's figure a way to have this conversation. Let's evolve the brands. Let's figure that out, you know?
And how I think, did the conversation start? I mean, is it a six-month conversation, a two-week conversation? Well, when did it all begin?
Well, I mean, you know, I own a company that produces TV shows, and I essentially wanted to take something on. And I looked towards Dialo Media, and they had some brands. And Dialo Media obviously had Destiny and Destiny Man and Mentor Feed and all these other things. And I wanted to really play with this online digital world. I already have like a little small magazine called The Bar. It was online. And I thought the only thing missing was a strong online offering for Destiny and Destiny Man. And this was about a year ago that I approached Kanye Lomo. This was when, obviously, the company was still running and the magazines seemed to be, you know, quite healthy as well. And that conversation started out as, you know, me sort of trying to become a service provider to Dialo Media. I think a few months later, she then decided to liquidate. So a self-appointed liquidation would mean that the conversations then ended, and then I would then go, you know, to whoever the liquidator was and held those brands in the meantime. And I approached the liquidator, you know, to say, hey, I'm interested in buying. And that took about 4 months or 6 months or so, yeah.
Okay, so a long process. A lot of people are concerned about Kanye. She's disappeared off the face of the earth. I mean, I'm clear she's had a horrible year. She really has. Nobody likes to go through the position where you're obliged to liquidate a business. And Dialo Media had so many great titles and had so many wonderful many years behind it. I mean, have you kept in touch with her at all? Is she doing okay?
Look, I mean, I had a relationship with her before, and I think she is okay. She's doing really well. Yeah. The obvious thing is that she lost brands that she really cared about, that she really worked hard on. And, you know, when she made the decision, she made an educated decision, a decision that was better for everyone. You know, even before she liquidated, I know now that she actually tried to do a lot to save the company. You know, somebody like that doesn't just liquidate, you know. She got to a point where I now understand that she couldn't necessarily save the company.
Look, I mean, a lot of people are grumpy, and I mean, that happens. Unfortunately, when a business fails, people get hurt, and lives change very, very dramatically. Did you get them at a decent price? They would have had liabilities, I'm sure. The assets are the titles.
Yeah.
There'd be client lists, there'd be advertisers.
I think the biggest liability has been to make sure that people understand that we are back, and from the advertiser to, you know, the consumer, everyone needed to be really sure. Like, even how we came back. I mean, I released a press release on Friday, and by Monday, they were on shelf, you know. So essentially, I didn't want the conversation to, you know, I guess, go out of hand. The reason why we're back is because there's a really, really big opportunity for South Africa to engage in business. You know, this world isn't easy to access. And I think that has been the biggest liability. But in terms of how much I got them for, I'd like to keep that private.
It's your business. Yeah. Entirely your business. I mean, I take it wasn't you. It wasn't like Choppies, which has been sold for R1 and...
No, I mean, these brands were worth a lot. Yeah, okay. They were worth a lot.
Have you changed them dramatically? Are they fundamentally a different offering to what they were 6 months ago, a year ago?
So what I want to say is that this is more of an evolution rather than a revolution. So there are some things that have changed and there are some things that will stay the same because the magazine itself, you know, wasn't bad. I think it was essentially the running of the business around the magazine that wasn't necessarily the best, you know.
And when you look at, I mean, this is something so fundamentally different to what you've done before. Publishing online is very, very different to ink and paper and distribution,
yeah.
And expense, because every single one of those magazines costs you, you know, a lot of money to produce.
Yeah.
Printing is not cheap. Yeah. How hard was it to change your thinking around a business title like Destiny?
It wasn't hard. I think, you know, I've always been a fan of the brands and I've always bought them. I think I had a plan. When I approached Kanye, I really wanted to implement this plan. I think it was the solution to what would, you know, evolve us into something more. You know, people these days are saying print is dying. I think people have more, I guess, options around prints, you know, so you can access it through the internet, you can access it through actually going and buying a physical copy. But what I found is that people are actually using multiple platforms at the same time. Whilst they still love the feel of the magazine, they still also want quick bites of, you know, news. But sometimes, you know, you really can't take the internet to the beach. You can't take the internet everywhere. And so that's where I think we are thinking is that we won't please everybody. And in our products, we mustn't try please everybody. We must actually look for those who actually still love and, you know, believe in print. And that's basically what I'm here to do.
I want to pick that up in a moment, Legend.
Yeah.
Legend Mankele is the chief executive and founder at The Bar Group and recently buying Destiny magazines. Bit of breaking news for you this evening. On a presidency letterhead to all ministers and deputy ministers. Developments at SAA. And it is from the Secretary of the Cabinet, Cassius Lubisi, PhD. Blah, 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 blah. Cabinet approach, blah, blah, blah. The important bit here. SAA will urgently go into voluntary business rescue. This is the only viable route open to the government and avoid uncontrolled implosion of the national airline. Voluntary business rescue approach will also prevent liquidation applications by any of SAA's creditors to land the airline in even worse position. We remain seized with the SAA crisis and will keep members of the executive informed at all material times. Well, there's a bit of breaking news for this evening. We need to talk to somebody about this, Cecile. Who do we get? In a moment, let's pick up on this story. Legend, don't move. We need to catch up with you too.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that believes long-term partnerships deliver sustainable results. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
In a world where print media is largely believed to be dead and dying, Legend Mankele is the chief executive and founder at The Bar Group, and he has bought himself the Destiny magazines, Destiny Man and Destiny. What gives you faith in the future of print?
I think, you know, there's a lot of research that has gone into it. Knowing that Destiny wasn't a dying brand and people still wanted to hear from, you know, the brands. I mean, when Kanye announced that she was closing, a lot of people, you know, were kind of hurt and affected. Aside the employees, which are also very dear to me, you know, which is why there's a two-sided, I guess, reason here. So I'm in the industry and I believe that we are in a content era, you know. A platform like that cannot die. But a platform like that, that has been, I guess, a mentor to so many people, just like myself, needs to exist. And, you know, some of us have the answer in how to move this platform forward. So I think that's what gives me the faith. Like, I've done my research. I know what's needed. And in fact, I think I'm going to grow the platform much more, you know?
I hope so, because I love nothing more than the feel of a magazine. I mean, you're in an airport, you pick up a magazine, it's short, sharp reads, if it's well written, if it's well done, the layout should be beautiful, the photography should be beautiful.
Yeah.
There's an experience contained between the covers of a magazine. And depending on the frequency, you either get a very glossy, high-quality publication or one that's put together more quickly.
Yeah.
And I really hope it succeeds. But it's critical. I mean, a large proportion of your pages need to be covered by advertising. How have advertisers responded to the regeneration of the brand?
If I can tell you, I mean, I don't know if anyone will believe me, but there are so many people that are coming and knocking at our door saying, thank you very much. We didn't know where to advertise. These brands spoke to a certain part of our country that no one could reach, you know? And so I think I'm very impressed at bringing these magazines back, because I actually, you know, with all the research that I'd done, I was still very nervous, partly because of how they ended and the controversy around these brands, you know. And so, you know, in the first issue, there were a few people that were going, but okay, who's the new editor? Who are you, legend? What are you going to do differently? You know, are we going to find ourselves in the same situation? And, you know, now that they're on shelves, people are actually going, who's your next issue? What's going on? It's actually quite overwhelming, you know, and I'm actually really grateful. You know, just this morning, I sat in a meeting, a very important meeting, and, you know, I have a very big buy-in from a very big bank, you know, so it's very, very interesting right now.
I mean, such an interesting space, and I really do hope you succeed. I mean, do you have, what, 50-50 advertising versus editorial? What's the split?
So I think there shouldn't be a line in between that. I think everything should be somewhat considered as content. So even in how we're sort of changing our...
You're not going to turn it into an advertorial rag, are you?
No. Definitely okay, not.
But, just checking. I'm an old-fashioned guy who believes very firmly in the gap between advertising and content. But that's
I hear you. But, you know, the audience isn't stupid anymore. You know, they want real advertising. They want things that will move them forward. You know, magazines these days, and I think that's why people aren't reading, is because every second page is an advert that's not speaking to me, that's not speaking about anything. I think for me, I want to be able to, you know, really curate a magazine that speaks about, you know, things that are important and that advertises around things that are important. You know, we're dealing with business here. It's a big thing. You know, it's not just a small thing where, you know, I can infuse it with any type of ad. It needs to actually add and extend the message at a very big level, you know? Mm. So I think magazines need to be thought of, and they need to be thought, they need to be decisions. They can't just be slapped together and put together just because there's advertising, I must take it. I'm also very aware that, you know, the audience is discerning, and I cannot do what all the other people are doing out there, just taking the money and moving.
How deep are your pockets? Because these things can take time to, I'm not asking for numbers, but I mean, these things take time to generate returns.
Yeah.
You've had to expend capital, you've had to hire people.
Yeah.
I'm assuming you managed to get some of the people who were destined before back.
Definitely.
They would have they would understand the DNA of the business.
Institutional knowledge, yeah. I'm willing to play it for long. This is a long game, you know. That's all I'm going to say on that question. I'm here to stay, and it's a long game.
How much more terrifying, less terrifying, is it than generating television content? Because TV content is big and demanding and hairy and time-consuming. Magazines are a different beast.
Yeah, but I think, though, the same principles apply. You know, consider the people that you're talking to. Understand that you are talking to the people and not talking at them or talking down to them. It's a conversation. Whilst producing something for people, you must also allow them to consume and produce it back to you by way of feedback. I'll tell you, the most terrifying thing to do has been this interview. so far.
Come on. It's like coming to the teddy bear's picnic.
Never. This is both a career highlight and also just like, stop. This is crazy.
But I mean, the thing is, we need to ensure that, and I like to call people like you rebels, renegades, and problem solvers. People who come in and go where, you know, normal people fear to tread are courageous. I mean, you take and you put it into a project and you work blooming hard, but hell, you need so many things going in your favor in order for it to succeed. You need a consumer market that is going to go to a shop and choose it or subscribe or go online into a digital platform and participate the way you want them to participate. You need advertisers to come in. You need the right people to write the right content to deliver to an audience that wants that. And it's just this never-ending treadmill of content production, and it's demanding.
I think the most important thing, with all those things said, you also need a board, people who are actually invested in the decisions you're making and who can come around and congregate to actually see you move forward. Sometimes, you know, as business people, we forget that boards are very important. So I'm currently sort of trying to figure that out because, you know, your kitchen cabinet is your business. You cannot run this thing alone. Whilst I have a certain view about this industry, many other people that can sit around a table and see me through, I think that for me will be the most important thing, you know. Running a company isn't easy. You can be focused, but you can also lose a lot of sort of perspective around this world. You know, it's demanding. A magazine isn't easy. Anything that we do in business isn't easy. Going down a path less traveled isn't easy, you know. So you need a good team around you, a good bunch of people that can say, well, pivot this way, go this way. You need funding? Okay, you can access it this way, you know?
You need funding? Go to hell. Yeah. Legend, listen, good luck with it. I think you've got a good chance as anybody in making these things work. You've got a marvelous. I haven't seen the Destiny cover, but I've seen the cover of John Carney, and he's so alluring and so engaging and so big and warm and delicious.
Thank you.
As a human being, and I look forward to watching you flourish. I really hope you make it work. We need great diversity in media. We need more titles. We need more choice. And advertisers need places to put messages. And so I hope.
Well, that's why we started with Pepe Marais, who's our first issue.
And he's also, I mean, Pepe has taken the world by storm.
He is insane. What a brilliant story. You know,
he is.
He owns a big advertising agency.
He does.
Strategically placed.
I get you. Oh, hey, you started on the right foot. Legend Montgomery. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, sir.
Founder of The Bar Group, owners of Destiny.
Bruce Whitfield on 702.
It's that moment where you see on a letterhead something that looks incredibly genuine, and it looks like a letter from the Cabinet Office saying that the President has instructed that SAA go into business rescue. Guy Leach, the managing editor at SA Flyer magazine, have you been able to verify the veracity of that letter?
Hi, Bruce. No, unfortunately, I haven't. And I have to say off the top of my head, it's extremely hard to believe. There are many good reasons why SAA has been vehemently opposed to business rescue. We know already that SAA has been literally forced into a corner by Solidarity Trade Union having applied for business rescue proceedings. But that's a process still in place. And not a month ago, Pravin Gordhan was insisting that he would rather close the airline down rather than let it go into business rescue, simply because of the knock-on effects in terms of the cross-linkages, in terms of guarantees on all the SAA debt. So it's very hard to believe. But at the same time, I think that it does give the government, the state-owned Ministry of State-Owned Enterprises, the leverage to perhaps put in a management team that can hopefully turn it around.
I look at this letter and I do... It looks genuine, and that's the trouble with these blooming things. We watch the space, and thank you for your circumspection, Guy Leach, this evening. But there is a letter. It's on what looks like a presidency letterhead. It looks genuine, but yes, we've yet to exactly determine the veracity of these claims. Guy Leach, thank you. Managing editor at SA Flyer magazine. The writing's a bit squiff on the page. It could just be the paper was skew... We watch this space very closely. The report this evening, the suggestion is SAA into business rescue. Is it real? We will be chasing Eyewitness News. No doubt we'll be chasing.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that believes long-term partnerships deliver sustainable results. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
Carol Payton, A Business Day, is talking about SAA this evening and saying that an official statement could come out later on this evening. It looks genuine. SAA running out of runway. That was the story I wrote this morning. Yeah, it's nothing. You don't want to be happy about it. But yeah, the thing needs to... We don't need it to crash and burn. It's tourist season. People, it's Christmas. People need their jobs. It's not their fault that their previous generations of crooks, thieves, scoundrels, vagabonds, fraudsters... Stopping now. Good night.